From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Humans are intensely attuned to the sound of their world, always have been. Caesar banned chariots overnight to let Romans sleep. Dickens complained bitterly about street musicians, bangers of banjos, he said. Now more than ever, we exercise a lot of technical control over sound to pick it apart, engineer in what we like and out what we don't, to sculpt and design sound, or pop on headphones and hear only what we want. How has it changed the world? This hour on Point Living in the age of sculpted sound. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What's the soundscape we're creating with our growing technical powers? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first today from Washington is Megan Garber, staff writer at The Atlantic. Her latest big piece is Sonic Boom: How Digital Technology is Transforming Our Relationship with Sound. You can link to it from our website, onpointradio.org. Megan Garber, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We'll talk about the transformation. I love your historical little tour of how people have always tried to manipulate the sound around them, control it a little bit. Caesar was doing what with wagons overnight in Rome?
He was trying to limit their noise. Cobblestones are very noisy. Wooden wheels are very noisy. And he got sick of it. He was sleeping in the town just like everyone else and, wanted to get his rest. So he tried to ban that noise and to prevent people from having their wagons operating at certain hours.
You take it all the way back to the ancient Epic of Gilgamesh. And the gods there complaining that the uproar of mankind is intolerable. Of course, humans wrote this. And what do they have gods do?
Basically, the Epic of Gilgamesh, first of all, is the background, some believe, to the story of Noah. So basically, the gods in this epic convened a council where the god Enlil complained about the noises that humans were making, and they decided to flood mankind to punish them for the noises that they were making and also silence them.
So they were so upset about the clamor on Earth that they would exterminate mankind for that. And then there's this
which
one.
Which seems appropriate, you
yes,
know.
Yeah, sure. Then there's this wonderful letter to the British Parliament, 1864. It's signed by Charles Dickens, Thomas Carlyle, Alfred Lord Tennyson. And, I mean, they're just being driven batty by street noise in London. Beaters of drums, grinders of organs, bangers of banjos, clashers of cymbals, worriers of fiddles, bellowers of ballads. And what? They want a crackdown.
They want a crackdown. It was so noisy. And their argument, it was a very sort of elitist argument, but their argument was that, you know, their minds were so valuable and they had to think such, you know, big and good thoughts for the benefit of all mankind that they needed their silence. They needed their peace and quiet. And all the banjos and all the drums and all the street musicians were making it basically impossible for them to think their big thoughts.
The point of your piece, really, Megan, is that we now have more technical capacity for controlling, shaping, sculpting sound than we've ever had before. And you say it is transforming our relationship with sound. How so?
It really is. Digital technology is just like everything else. It's changing our relationship with sound. It's giving us a much more sort of nuanced approach to sound, basically, where we can sort of break sound down into its component parts. So we can sort of move beyond just the decibel itself as this sort of almost brute measurement of noise. And we can look at the different components of, you know, the bass levels and the higher notes. And there's a new field called psychoacoustics, basically, that really tries to measure the psychological effect of different noises and the different sort of components of noises. So high-pitched noises will annoy us in one particular way, and low-pitched noises will annoy us in another way. So we can really try to calibrate those sounds and the components of sounds to create sort of ideal sound environments.
We're going to bring in an engineer who works on exactly that kind of project in just a couple of minutes here. It's amazing how intensely people care about sound. I've got a little sound right here. This is from a 1929 newsreel, and this is Roger Galt of Bell Laboratories measuring the sound level with his assistant, I guess, Parkinson, in Times Square before a crowd of onlookers. Just listen.
30, 35, 40, 41, 42. Parkinson, make it 42. The noise in Times Square deprives us of 42% of our hearing.
Parkinson, make it 42. And here's a little sound. This is ambient sound of Times Square on a day in that year, 1929. This is from Professor Emily Thompson's website. We'll hear from her in a moment. Times Square, 1929. Okay. And right away, we kind of feel like we're in some kind of fuzzy old movie there. Let's bring it right up to date. 80 years later, Times Square, 2011. Sounds a little more pedestrian, a little more even pastoral, if that can possibly be the case. Megan Garber, what's the scale of the case that you're making here? Do we live in a different sonic world because of these technical innovations you're talking about?
I think in some ways we do. I think we certainly have the ability to calibrate noises for ourselves. I mean, I think earbuds actually and earphones in general are really changing the way that we relate to sound. You know, just this ability to sort of shelter ourselves into our own sort of sonic environments, you know, almost independent of all those street noises that you just played, we can tune those out. When I lived in New York City, often that was my sort of defense mechanism against the sounds of the city, was just to, you know, put in my earbuds and listen to the music that I wanted to listen to the radio that I wanted to listen to, and just sort of create my own environment. So I think that really has changed a lot and really has transformed the way that we approach sound. But on the other hand, you know, we've always tried to control sound, and we've always had this very sort of complicated relationship with the sounds that exist around us. And sounds have always had sort of a civic element to them. One of my favorite facts when I was researching this piece is that the bells of old, you know, medieval towns in Europe would essentially define the circumference of the town. Essentially, if you lived within earshot of the bell, you were part of that town. And if you lived beyond earshot of the bell, you were not part of it, because the bell would control the scheduling of days, and it would tell you when it was time to go to market and when it was time to go to prayer. So really, you know, sounds have always had this very sort of intimate control over our lives. It's just a matter of – it's changing a little bit with our new technologies.
Of course, we can bring that digital technology in to sculpt sound. It also adds sound to our environment. Not everybody likes it. Let me go to our listeners, if I may. St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Pete's calling. Hi, Pete. You're on the air with Megan Garber.
Oh, hi.
Hi there.
My complaint is the beeps. There's way too many beeps in the world, and most of them are totally unnecessary. It takes six or seven beeps just to pump your gas, you know, at the gas pump. There's no reason for that. And there's all kinds of beeps and alarms and all kinds of weird noises in my new car, which are totally unnecessary and very distracting. They raise my blood pressure, you know, and that's not a joke. I think we've probably raised everyone's blood pressure because there's all these damn beeps. And I think the world would be better off with far fewer beeps.
Drive out the beeps and maybe the tweets and the chirps and everything else that our digital stuff does these days. Megan, what about it on balance? Do you think we've created a more soothing environment? Or, I mean, here's Pete calling and saying, that get these beeps away from me.
Yeah, it's a really good point. I mean, I think, you know, on the one hand, yes, things have become more soothing just because, you know, we do, like I said, we do have this sort of ways of controlling it a little bit more. You know, if you have these beeps that you don't like, I mean, the gas station is one example. But then, you know, for a lot of the beeps that we have in our, you know, digital devices and all of that in our phones and our computers, often we are given the option to turn those off if we don't like them. So it's, you know, infrastructurally, you know, there aren't that many instances of at least that I can think of the beat sort of, you know, becoming too invasive. But at the same time, I think, I mean, one of the things that really interested me about the work that acoustic engineers are doing right now is that, you know, I think we're beginning to realize how much of a sort of psychological impact those little noises have in the aggregate on us. Like you said, they add to our stress level. They can make us feel kind of twitchy and, you know, just annoyed all the time. And I think people are beginning to realize that and really think about sound as a design element, just like all the visual and aesthetic components of design. We're starting to think about sound as part of that as well.
Tech gives us the power to shape it. It can also drive us crazy. Witness the pleading at the beginning of any public event. Please turn those off. Sean in Nashville, Tennessee. Thanks for calling, Sean. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah. I'm an audio engineer out here in Nashville, and I think there are a lot of people that understand that sound is beginning to become a design element that's more and more on the front of the stage these days. But one of the things that people can miss, and she was beginning to touch on this, is it can cause a positive or negative emotional response as well. When you watch, for instance, campaign ads, the music or sounds that are happening in the background can cause an emotional response. Or when you listen, as she was mentioning, to a car door closing that has been designed and engineered to be luxurious, that sound causes a response. It's something that we associate with that.
Sean, how clued in are people to this now? You're an audio engineer. Are people saying to you, hey, Sean, come and create a positive, emotional sound environment for us?
It doesn't often happen like that. It's normally somebody says, come and run the sound for us, and I do what I know to do. For instance, I don't mean to get into a religious discussion, but sermons are often the primary source of this. I mean, when you have a pad or strings or piano music lightly playing in the background, the emotional response that comes from that is very important to the speaker's presentation.
Sean's going to run the sound system for church on Sunday morning and really drive the preacher's message home with that background pattern. I can believe that, Sean, and I appreciate your call from Nashville. Megan Garber with The Atlantic, please stand by. We're going to bring in an audio engineer right after a short break here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about the sound of our world and how it's being increasingly shaped by technology, engineered from the sound of your blender to your car door to the built environment around you. Megan Garber is with us from The Atlantic. Her big piece there is Sonic Boom, How Digital Technology is Transforming Our Relationship with Sound. Are manufacturers thinking about it? You bet they are. Here's a commercial from Volkswagen in 2012 promoting their Jetta sedan by focusing on one key feature, the sound of the car door.
The solid thunk of the door on the Jetta, another example of Volkswagen quality. That's the power of German engineering.
And it's all in the sound. Audi doing the same on their website, highlighting how an acoustic engineer creates an artificial sound for a future model of an electric car.
Helpmeier creates the sound of the future for Audi in the lab. He is currently working on the Audi R8 e-tron supercar.
Electric cars don't have much of a sound, so maybe they're inspired by the cello for what that car will sound like. Megan, stand by. With me right now in the studio is Robert Behrens. He's supervisory consultant at Accent Tech, an acoustics engineering firm in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Robert Behrens, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
So there's Audi telling us that they're going to make their car sound something like a zooming cello. Does that make sense to you? Can you wizard up that kind of audio result in any product you like?
It's very easy to do. It's a matter of is it appropriate and are people going to accept it? Are people going to pay attention to it, or are people going to stand in the street in awe and get run over? So it's a challenge, but it's certainly technically feasible.
Megan says, we'll hear in a moment from Emily Thompson. Megan says that we are out there now actively engineering the sound of the world around us. How far into that project do you feel like we are these days?
Oh boy. Well, we're certainly doing things with all sorts of appliances and little gizmos that you use around the house or that you would run into in everyday life. My company's been working on things like washing machines and vacuum cleaners, trying to make a vacuum cleaner sound more desirable than its competitor. We break down the sound. We look into why it sounds the way it sounds, how we can make it sound different, and how we can make it sound better according to a wide variety of people.
It's curious what better means and the fact that we decide before it ever hits the store what that's going to be. Let's jump into one of those. We've got a little tape. This is recorded at Ascentec, your company. Here's the full sound of a washing machine. Maybe you can then help us break it down. So here's a washing machine. Hey, I don't know. Is that a good washing machine or a bad washing machine?
Well, it really depends on how people perceive it. And one of the things we do is we will go into one of our test chambers and mask off all of the different component sound, what makes an individual little snippet of sound. The pumps make a particular sound. The drum makes a particular sound. The water swishing around makes a different sound. Well, then record those, mix them back in different proportions, and then play them back to a jury, a bunch of people mm-hmm. under very carefully controlled circumstances, and ask them, do they like this and do they like that? And we'll compare, we'll tweak up the pump sound a little bit, and we'll ask them again. And we do this with lots of people, and the differences are very, very subtle. And we come up with, this is what a lot of people like. And then we'll go back to the manufacturer and say, okay, here is what you have to do to your pump to make that pump component of the overall washing machine be appropriate for the overall sound that it makes.
Megan, I mean, here we are. Multiply that times, I don't know, hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of products, and pretty soon we're surrounded by things that are designed to just sound the way we like, to make us smile. It's that cumulative effect in part, Megan, that you're writing about.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I love that idea. And, one of the things that I thought was so interesting when I was researching this piece is just I had never really thought about the very, particular psychological components of noises and how, something that's high pitched will just make me more annoyed, which I sort of knew implicitly, but hadn't really thought about as something that could be calibrated. And one of the other things that I was really intrigued by when I was researching the story was a prototype for a device that you can basically attach to your window. It's called Sono. It's designed by a designer in Shanghai. And you can essentially use it to sort of tune in the music of the birds outside and then tune out the traffic or basically any noises that you want to sort of, emphasize when you're inside. You can do that, and you can sort of downplay the bad noises. And again, it's a prototype, so this is not something that's necessarily going to be in our homes in the next couple years or so. But I think that is sort of where we're heading, where we are able to sort of just create in a very explicit way these sound environments. So that's sort of the next step up, I think, from the appliances, which I thought was really interesting.
I want to bring in Emily Thompson. She's professor of history at Princeton University, author of The Soundscape of Modernity. Emily Thompson, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
I wonder what you're thinking as we hear the Shanghai prototype. We hear about a prototype that will let us orchestrate almost the full spectrum of sound around us, even without earbuds. I mean, never mind retreating to your headphones, let's say. What does it mean, Emily, that we're moving from, I suppose we imagine a time in the past where sound just came to us and we accepted what came, to a present and future where we are creating, designing, sculpting the sound envelope we live in?
I think you're absolutely right. And while in many ways this digital technology is kind of a continuation of much longer term technological trends, I focus on the early 20th century, and certainly that desire for control of sound goes back, and a lot of early accomplishments in the 20th century began to move us in that direction. But with the widespread application of digital technology, I think we're really in the midst of an era where a kind of a change in degree, the degree of control that we have has become a kind of change in kind, that we're formulating a different relationship with our environment, not just our sonic environment, but our physical, our material environment more generally through the expanded possibilities that digital control allows us.
How far do you go with that, Emily? If, as our caller from Nashville says, sound is an important trigger for psychological response, for mood, if we start sculpting and engineering the entire sonic or big chunk of the sonic realm around us, are we in a way messing with our outlook on life?
I think we are in some ways that maybe we're not yet fully recognizing. And it's possible the technology has kind of pushed us into a realm where we're not quite sure what we should do with this wonderful power and control. And what I see, and I hope it's not just because I'm a sort of middle-aged vinyl fetishist who has, obviously as a historian, great nostalgia for the past, but what I see is a kind of a dissociation from our physical environments. And I think there are social dimensions to that, psychological, but perhaps more importantly, the ways that we relate to each other as human beings in the world. It's our sound environment, to the degree that we don't have control over it, forces us to engage with other people and to understand where we are, its problems as well as its benefits and opportunities. And if we can each just construct our own sound bubble, while in many ways that can be a good thing and can solve a lot of problems, whenever something is gained, something is lost too. So I guess I've been thinking a bit about what is lost as well.
If you've got your earbuds in deep and cranked up, you're in your own, by definition, your own sonic environment right there, disassociated maybe from the physical world, not to mention people around you. Jonathan in Arlington, Massachusetts. Thanks for calling, Jonathan. What do you think?
Well, hi, Tom.
Hi.
And, it's a pleasure to be here. So I'm an audio engineer also, and I had two things I wanted to raise. One is to amplify this point around being disassociated from the world around us as we begin to reassociate sounds with objects from which they might traditionally not originate. For instance, I was in a room the other day where somebody had a timer set to ring like an old-fashioned phone, and it went off, and I was looking around for the phone to answer, and in fact, it was just a reminder for that person to do something, and there was a disconnect. There was a real disorientation that it brought into my life, and I find that that's happening more and more. We can implant, if you will, the sound of one object into another, and suddenly the disconnect happens where, you know, what we've learned to associate with a particular object, it just doesn't sound that way anymore.
And that sound of the old-fashioned phone is so evocative of a time distant now, Jonathan, but you're right, it can come off of anything these days.
That's right, and I guess maybe I'm showing my age there by invoking that particular response, but, you know, in general, I think we're seeing this happening more and more where there isn't a sound necessarily associated with a task or with an object or... As I think it was Robert from the Centec. Anyway, he was talking about cars sounding like something different. Well, how do you know to get out of the way of the car? So that disconnect is somewhat unnerving to me as a person moving through life. So
and you can shuffle the deck. I mean, you can apply almost any sound to any physical activity, Robert Behrens.
Yeah, absolutely. We can make anything sound like anything else, pretty much. Certainly with headphones and earbuds, things like that. We've been doing it in the recording industry for years and years. We make bad singers sound good, and we listen to them at home, and we think we're at a concert. So it's an evolution. We're certainly sort of broadening the horizon of what we can do, where we can place those sounds, where we can place you psychologically. So I think we're heading in a different direction, but I don't think it's particularly surprising or particularly strange or scary.
Emily's a little worried about it, about the dissociation of the physical or even the social from the sound that's actually in our minds. I mean, sometimes it's disturbing to people for all kinds of reasons. We keep coming back to automobiles, but there's a controversy around the sound of Formula One racing this year. In the new season, all Formula One race cars are required to have a new hybrid engine. Problem is, these engines are much quieter, and a lot of the fans don't like it. I've got a little sound here, a comparison. On the same track in Melbourne, Australia, of the sound of F1 racing last year versus this year. You'll hear a 2013 race first, then a pause, then the sound from March of this year. All right, there's a change technology and much less of that high-pitched whine that got people all excited and cranked up in the past. So is that a Centec opportunity, Robert, to come in and bring back the old screaming drama?
Oh, boy. I don't know. And when I was many years ago, we did some – I was working for the city of Boston. And we were trying to reduce the noise from jackhammers, and we found that there is, in fact, a jackhammer muffler available. And we decided that, oh, we're the city of Boston. We can control this and make our DPW workers wear mufflers on their jackhammers. Problem was they got really quiet, and all of the workers said, this thing doesn't work anymore.
Yeah.
So it's not doing what it does. I need the power. Even though it didn't change the fundamental amount of work that the jackhammer could do.
Without the sound, they just didn't believe it.
They just didn't like it. And, you know, sort of the same idea that there's a psychological association to loud sounds being powerful sounds, the high-pitched turbine whine. That's speed, that's power. And certainly in the electric hybrids, you don't hear anything. And there's a disconnect there.
I think Formula One is looking at bringing back some of that big sound. Jackhammer, a little more quiet. Somebody's relieved and someone else is kind of alienated from the tool
exactly,
they're
yes.
working with. Where's my power? Megan Garber, you write about sculpting sound on a bigger scale, maybe outdoor amphitheaters. You write about one in Atlanta grappling with some tensions because they've got a residential neighborhood nearby. They're trying to figure out how to live in harmony with their neighbors without having them bring out the pitchforks. What's the answer been, Megan?
Well, it's sort of always a compromise, and this is actually something that Bob worked on as well and told me about. But it becomes this question of, you know, you've got this music just kind of radiating out from this amphitheater, and you know, for some people, sometimes it will be jazz, sometimes it will be an orchestra, sometimes it will be R&B or rock, and so you know, all these sort of subjectivities that are built into our appreciation of sound were sort of coming into play because you know, you might interpret R&B as being a lot louder if you don't happen to like R&B, then you would interpret orchestral music or jazz music or something like that. And so the city was really having to sort of navigate all those tensions. And so I think, I mean, as Bob put it, you know, basically the matter is, you know, as it is with all policy, you just have to find one single solution and try to not anger as many people as possible, basically. So that's what happens. You just sort of, you know, develop one sort of standard and hope that will work.
And dissect the sound to know what really annoys people. Imagine Lady Gaga playing at that Chastain Park, the amphitheater in Atlanta. Right in front of the stage might sound like this. Listen through a wall, let's say, or from a distance, and here's what travels. It's that big bass having the neighbors grinding their teeth in the night. Robert Behrens, can you get in there in a public setting like that and do something about that? Can you work with the band or the environment to muffle that somehow?
Well, controlling it is very difficult because certainly the artist wants the sound to be the sound that they want to produce. The people on the soundboard want the artist to sound great. The venue wants to fill up the stadium with ticket buying patrons that came to hear the sound that they want to hear, and the neighbors are trying to sleep, and they're across the street from the stage, and trying to meet all of those requirements of keeping the neighbors happy and the concert goers happy and the artists happy is a very difficult tightrope. And when we were down there, we listened to a lot of concerts. We did a lot of measurements, a lot of recording. Trying to figure out what is exactly the sound that makes the neighbors most annoyed. And we really determined that it was that thump, 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 yeah, thump.
Coming through the wall.
Coming through the wall when they were trying to, you know, when their kids were trying to sleep. So we actually crafted a regulation that was specifically targeted to that low frequency sound. So there is a limit on just a very narrow range of low frequency sound. We found that the highs, the cymbals and the vocalists and even the high guitars doesn't really matter. They can be pretty loud, but they don't travel and they don't go through buildings and windows as much as the low frequencies. So we really targeted the low frequency end of things to and it's been actually quite successful. I think we've managed to make everybody reasonably happy.
So if you hear Lady Gaga going to falsetto and cymbals and flute after a certain hour, maybe you can blame Bob Behrens for that. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the sound of our world and how it's being increasingly deliberately shaped by technology, engineering, from the sound of your blender to your car door to the built environment around you. Behind us there, the sound of Bourbon Street in New Orleans. There was a big effort recently to shape the sound of that street, to bring in some of the clamor a little bit, take out maybe some kinds of sound, some range of sound of the audio spectrum. Didn't pass yet, but that's where we're headed. A lot more manipulation of sounds around us on all sides. Megan Garber writes about it in The Atlantic. She joins us this hour from Washington, D.C. Robert Behrens makes it happen with Ascentec in Cambridge, Massachusetts. They'll take your product and make it sound more or less any way you'd like it to sound. Emily Thompson is a historian at Princeton University. She wrote The Soundscape of Modernity, and it is changing. Of course, in the news in the last few days here, Apple moving to buy Beats by Dr. Dre, the headphones and the streaming music. We're going to look at that acquisition effort in particular in just a minute, to look at why they're doing that. Interesting in itself. I wonder from our listeners, Phil in Cheshire, Connecticut. Phil, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. My issue is I'm really surprised to hear anybody who thinks that noise or sound, depending on your point of view, is becoming less and less. I no longer know that it's spring because I hear crickets and robins. I know it's spring because I hear Harleys. And Harley successfully sued Yamaha when Yamaha came out with a model of bikes meant to imitate Harleys down to the sound that came out of the so-called muffler. And Harley actually won. But nobody asked the question, why are we allowing this noise to pollute our lives in the first place? If Caesar could do it back in Rome, yes. Why are we allowing corporations to pollute our environment with noise as a selling point?
Phil, I love it. I'm looking here. One of our listeners online writes, quoting Jean-Paul Sartre, says, hell is other people's noise. In your case, Harleys instead of crickets. Harleys paid a lot of attention to that sound. I don't know, Emily, how about it? In the range of responses, where are we in terms of saying we have a right to decide what we hear and what we don't? Caesar said, keep the chariots off the streets at night. Phil would like the Harleys off the streets of his Connecticut town.
Well, that's why I find noise and sound so interesting as a historian, because it's not just about, you know, vibrating air and then the sound itself. It's really a sonic window into social relations and who gets to legislate and how you go about solving noise problems. In many ways, noises are complained about when there's also something else that people are worried about, the kind of person making the noise, the particular kind of commercial or social activity that's generating the noise. We're often worried about that as much as the noise itself. So there's a lot to learn by thinking about noise and the different ways that people go about trying to control it. The digital technology to actually shape sound is just one aspect. Zoning laws, that amphitheater might not have been built if there were zoning legislation that required a space, you know, between such a structure and residential communities. In the early 20th century, when there was also a lot of worry about the problem of the noise of the modern world, people tried to shape people's behavior through rules and regulations or just to try to promote different social norms, and it really didn't work. So they turned to the solution of really just trying to build shelters from the noise, new approaches for acoustical design of interior spaces. And Robert's company certainly has been working on this for many years too, so that you can escape from the noise. Headphones become a way to escape even when you're out in the midst of the world. So there are lots of complicated relationships embodied in how and why we control noise and sound, I think.
One man's sweet Harley roar, another man's nightmare. And we see that again and again. David in Oklahoma City. David, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
We control noise, but I was interested in the 80s, Denver International Airport, 2 in the morning. Kids were, before earbuds, using boom boxes, you know, boom, boom, boom.
Mm-hmm.
1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning, this lady, middle-aged lady, had a huge boom box playing Mozart. And what happened to the landscape at the airport when those people were hearing, it changed everything. They started to listen. They didn't tune it out. And the sonic landscape became part of the reality for us. There were 20 or 30 people that were there.
So what do we take from that, David? Are we in a competition to define our sonic space? Your boombox, you know, your hip-hop versus her Mozart?
I don't know. I when people get on the street with the noise coming out of the cars, it's like, my reality must be your reality. You must join mine or you're lost.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, manufacturers pushing that at us as well. Megan, here's a listener online writes to us, I hate added noises. And this kind of goes to your theme, Megan. It says, why does every button I push need to make a sound? ATM, phones, etc. I really hate the approximations of noises that used to be a result of function, but now are just noise like camera noises on digital cameras. The sound of a phone ringing should tell you, just tell you the phone is ringing, not be a vehicle for self-expression. The way we're sort of engineering in approximations of whatever we think the sound ought to be from that digital device, Megan, is a very conscious choices being made.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point. I mean, I do think sound as sort of signal. I mean, that has been, you know, just a trend throughout history where sounds haven't just been aesthetic realities. They have been, you know, they actually are information. They tell us things that we need to know about our world. And so I think what this writer is describing is sort of a continuation of that, where we're trying to sort of embed those signals in our digital devices to tell us things about how the devices work.
But is that pollution? Is that cuteness? What is that?
It's a good question. You know, I mean, again, it goes back to that subjectivity question. For some people, it's pollution. For others, it's cuteness. I think what I think is going to happen, my hunch, is that we'll just basically the companies that are making these designs will just give us more options for controlling the noises that we have in our machines, essentially. So, you know, we can have more and more options to either not have sounds or to have very particular sounds. And that choice will be left up to the individual consumer. That's my hunch. I'm not sure. But that's where I think things would go.
Robert Behrens, I wonder where you think we're headed. We're going to hear in a moment about Beats and Apple and Dr. Dre, but their tagline from their recent ad campaign from Beats is, hear what you want. Not what's out there necessarily, but what you want. That is the sense of you'll have a designed audio environment.
Oh, boy. Well, I like to take walks without earbuds, so I'm the wrong person to talk to. I actually like to go out for a walk and listen to what's around me. It's a choice. I think that like everything, I think we have the ability to offer choices, and the more choices we have, the more people will opt different directions. And technology is remarkable. I don't think it's necessarily wrong or right or whatever, but I think it can be applied. It's the wave of the future. I don't think it's any value judgment either way.
So. Emily Thompson, I guess I get that, and it's amazing what humans have always done with sound. But I'll take my crickets like Bob when they're there. But these days, you can't assume that everybody hears what you hear when you're out on that walk. People are in many different pods at once, Emily.
No, that's true. So, you can hear whatever you want. That's a great privilege. But what you lose is sharing a sonic environment with the people around you.
Emily Thompson, professor of history at Princeton University. She's author of The Soundscape of Modernity. Emily, thank you very much for joining us today. Really great to have you here.
Thank you.
Robert Behrens with Ascentec in Cambridge, Massachusetts, out there engineering the next sounds we'll hear. Bob Behrens, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And Megan Garber, who got us onto this with her big piece in The Atlantic, Sonic Boom. Megan, thanks for joining us from Washington.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Well, we're going to stride right on into the sound world with a little business on the side. In a moment, why does Apple want Beats by Dr. Dre? This is On Point. Apple is reportedly buying Dr. Dre's Beats Electronics Company, its well-known Beats by Dr. Dre headphones and Beats Music streaming music service, for $3.2 billion. Apart from making Dr. Dre a lot of money, what does this deal mean? What's in it for Apple? A Facebook video posted last week by R&B singer and actor Tyrese Gibson, since taken down off the site, showed Gibson celebrating with Dr. Dre and appeared to confirm the big Apple deal.
Billionaire Boys Club, for real, homie. Huh? Yeah, fix your face. Fix your face.
You know that.
The Forbes list just changed. They need. Hey, it came out like 2 weeks ago. They need to update the Forbes list.
Oh, my.
The first billionaire in hip-hop.
Billionaire Boys Club. Joining me now from Boston is James McQuivey, Vice President and Principal Analyst at Forrester Research, author of Digital Disruption. James McQuivey, welcome back to On Point.
Well, thank you, Tom. Glad to be here.
We know Beats, most of us, from those cool-looking headphones you see all over. They came along after earbuds, brought earphones back, made them cool, round. That Beats look, it's kind of an Apple aesthetic in design terms, but surely that's not enough to bring out the $3.2 billion checkbook. What's going on here?
That's really the puzzling question right now. Apple hasn't spent this kind of money in its history, and certainly not recently. So when Apple makes a move this big, it really makes you wonder, do they see something that we don't? Because really, just getting into audio accessories is not worth Apple's time. If Apple wanted to make popular headphones, they certainly could. But what more do they want from Beats? And that's what's forcing a lot of us to go back to the books and pore over the possibilities.
What's the speculation there? Presumably at some point, either by action or words, they'll let us know. What are people thinking?
The most obvious place to look is in the new Beats Music service that Beats has just recently launched to compete with Spotify and other online streaming music services. Now, Apple, as we all know, has been in the music business now since it launched iTunes in 2003, but it has been in the business of selling you individual music tracks or albums, if you still believe in such a thing, but they have not chosen to get into this music streaming business, Pandora, Spotify, where you turn on the app and it gives you a stream of music, either a collection that someone else has curated or you yourself can curate. And Apple actually was famously resistant to that model. Well, Beats has that model. They've gotten into it very recently with some celebrity cachet, obviously associated with the founder. And Beats is, many are saying, Apple's easiest route into a music subscription business.
But how is that different from Apple's iTunes Radio? Isn't that streaming?
Well, iTunes Radio is based on music that you previously have access to or a certain amount of streaming. It's actually a very complicated non-competitor. The Beats music, you can go in and specify, I don't want to just listen to some list that someone at Apple has constructed. I want to specify the Rolling Stones. I want to specify Michelle Bareilles. Whatever it is you're into, you can pick. That's not the way Apple currently lets you stream music. They get to pick, and you can listen to their radio channels. In the world of Spotify and in the world of Beats, you're in charge. You can pick which track and when you want to listen to it, and that's a business that would be useful to Apple's customers, but it's something that Apple could have built at any time if they wanted to. They certainly didn't need to spend $3 billion on Beats just to have a music streaming service.
Now, when Google went out and spent a lot of money to buy Nest, and this is, of course, the internet-connected controls in your home for the temperature
thermostat
in your home. Everybody said, well, that's their way into a great big arena of internet everywhere, internet aware objects. And Nest makes your whole home an object that they can kind of get to understand and know and interact with. Is there potentially a comparable big strategy here with Apple and Beats?
That's exactly where I'm pointing us. What I believe is that just as Nest gives Google a route into the digital home, what Apple could do with Beats is get into the digital body. Maybe that's a phrase that people aren't comfortable with, but we're now seeing more wearable devices, fitness devices, not unlike the Nike Fuel Band or the Fitbit that many of your listeners are probably wearing right now, but to do more, to accomplish more, to be visible on your body in a way that current trackers are trying to be invisible. Well, Beats is all about being visible and having you see that brand on your body. Well, you could imagine if Apple is about to introduce some health and wellness wearable devices, that having the Beats brand to ride along could certainly help make those devices as attractive as possible.
So you're not talking about my earphones or my earbuds or my headphones taking my blood pressure or my brain waves, but this is a kind of signaling product for Apple.
Well, actually, your headphones can not read your brain waves, but can do your blood pressure. They can even check your blood oxygen levels by passing a certain frequency of light through the tissues in your earlobe. So that's actually already being done. LG was the first to announce a pair of headphones earlier this year that will do exactly that while you're running. But the problem with these very invasive medical kinds of devices is that people aren't really sure they want them on their person, and they're only going to let a company with a brand they really, really trust introduce that kind of experience. Well, Apple certainly has the technical trust and the brand cachet. Then add Beats as a company that has the cool factor going for it, and that combination might allow Apple to convince you to put some of these devices on your body, whether it's on your head, on your wrist, or at your waist.
What do you think about the branding here, James? I mean, you've got the hipness factor of Dr. Dre. We heard him there talking, you know, the Billionaire Boys Club, the cachet. Is that what Beats stands for, or is it the sober, confidence-inspiring branding of a real doctor, not Dr. Dre, if we're talking about the digital body?
You know, that's a really great problem, because on the one hand, you might think it's cool to wear a Beats device, but really, in the end, when you're talking about blood oxygen levels, it's not Dr. Dre that you're interested in. And I think this is a part of the puzzle of what Apple might care about in the Beats acquisition, if it does go through, is were they buying it for the access to put something on your body today, and then using Apple's brand strength, and maybe even partnerships with companies like Nike, get permission to talk to you about your health and wellness later on. And so this might be part of a bigger picture that they're assembling, and we might not actually know for several months what that picture is going to look like.
I mean, is it possible that it's just as simple as selling a bunch of those Beats headphones? I mean, I'm reading here in the Times, they make them for $14 and sell them for $450. That's an iPhone-style margin. Maybe that's attractive.
It's just not a growth business. It's not going to get Apple back to where Apple was in its glory days. And I think Tim Cook, where he is right now, he wants to show that he's got what it takes to make Apple still be the world-changing company that Steve Jobs originally envisioned it to be.
Apple, with so many billions in the bank these days, I guess 3.2 is not going to begin to break their bank. But it may be a signal on the strategy that they are just setting out on here. We'll be watching. James McQuibby with Forrester Research. Thank you very much for being with us, James. Wonderful to have you here.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us today. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.